I think what I'm going to talk about today connects pretty well with what Eric talked about yesterday, so motif finding, promoter analysis, all these kind of things, probably from a bit more practical application perspective. My background is in computer science, so I'm kind of as a secret agent here. I'm not even a physicist or a biologist, really. But I've moved in my, I guess, viewpoint of the whole thing closer to biology. So I guess that some of the things we talk about will be very biological, and I don't focus much on the algorithms, how we actually get there. But I'm happy to talk about this. I'll just ask later on if you really want to know about the details of generalized Sid Markov models or phylogenetic HMMs or things like that. In general, my group works in sequence analysis these days. I worked the work that I talk about today, this crop promoter analysis business, started actually even when I was an undergrad over 10 years ago, and went on to be my PhD project. As a postdoc, I did more post-transcriptional gene regulation, but as I heard from Nikolaus, that's not the topic this week, so we're not going to talk about this. And in my own group, I've started now going back actually to this crop promoter analysis topic, because we have a lot of species now to work with, and the crop promoter, as I look at it, is a very simple transcriptional cis-regulatory module, which is probably quite nice to study how it evolves and how it behaves in different species. I also do image analysis, but that's a topic I'm not going to talk about here at all. It is related to gene regulation, quantification of gene expression of these images that we saw, of these reporter constructs in C2 stains, GFP expression reporters. But again, if this sounds interesting or is related to any what you guys are doing, then just ask about that later. We've seen pictures like this before. I just want to bring everybody on the same page which sequence region we're actually looking at here. The typical eukaryotic gene has a structure of exons and introns. The start codon, so the part that's actually translated into a protein, can be somewhere not even necessarily in the first exon. Stop codon usually is, with a few exceptions, in the last exon, however. So the coding region will be between the start and the stop codon. People often refer to this as translation start site, but we are going to look at here's the transcription start site. So sort of the very beginning, the 5' end of a gene. And this is where the core promoter region is located. People talk about upstream sequences, they usually mean the region upstream of the transcription start site, even though for lower organisms, especially for yeast and so forth, before there was exact transcription start site mapping, when people talked about upstream sequences, they usually just took everything upstream of the translation start site. It's very tricky to annotate these parts, so our knowledge where these transcription start sites are is actually still not that complete, but there are ongoing efforts like what Michaela and what Eric talked about. So then you have all these other steps here, and there's variation in all of these steps in splicing and processing of the transcript, export, control of translation by microRNAs or degradation by microRNAs. All these things come later on. And all these things are regulated. And again, what we are looking at here is only the variation and the sequence signals that we see at that very first part. How does the polymerase actually recognize a gene and start transcribing it? So there's sort of a little bit of confusion often what people mean when they talk about promoter sequences. So what I talk about is the core promoter or basal promoter. That's what you usually hear referred to. This is the region here around the transcription start site, often denoted by +1. And when people talk about a core promoter region, they often mean a region around -50 to +50. So it actually does go into the transcribed sequence. It's not technically just upstream. Proximal promoter are sort of the sequence elements directly upstream close to the gene. And then, as we heard in lectures this week and last week, enhancer sequences are these modular blocks of transcription factor binding sites which are somewhere in the genome, upstream, downstream, in the introns, whatever. Yeah? It depends very much on the species. It looks like the higher you go, the further away the elements can be in general. So this distinction between enhancer and proximal promoter is often not that clearly defined. if you look in species like in yeast, we saw examples of that yesterday, so probably something of 500 to 1,000 nucleotides. For C. elegans, that seems to be a reasonably good assumption too, so people there, or the work that I've done there, is usually in the order of 1 kb that you look upstream. In flies, because enhancers play such a large role, they can be anywhere, right? So it's really tricky to say how far you should look upstream to find anything. The proximal promoter, I think, with people talk about this, would be around the order of 1 kb, 2 kb. So for instance, some of these sea urchin examples that we saw with Eric Davidson, I would call a proximal promoter. It's directly upstream. You have these modules that sort of go further upstream from the transcription start sites, and there's no distance that the thing is moduli and totally somewhere else. But again, as I said, that's sometimes not a clear definition anymore. You even see the same binding sites in enhancers and sometimes in the proximal promoter. So probably even if you were to find a cis-regulatory module in a proximal promoter, I'm not sure if people have done experiments to just stick them elsewhere, they would probably work fine as enhancer, at least in some cases. So it's a fluid thing. I think the distinction simply comes from that you had lower organisms where the concept of enhancers isn't really there. So you have all the elements close by the transcription start site, and then if you go further away, they simply can be elsewhere as well, and then you start seeing enhancers. But they're not really mutually exclusive. As I said, you have a working definition for some organisms that you simply look and say, okay, I'm looking at the proximal promoter, and I define this for the purpose of my study as being 1 kb, 2 kb upstream. And that's what you see in many papers actually happening. Okay. So in these regions, you see binding sites of specific transcription factors that confer activation at the right developmental stage, environmental response, tissue-specific, and so forth. In the core promoter region, you see interaction with the basal machinery. That means with the transcription factors that interact directly with the polymerase and guide the polymerase to the transcription start site. But in bacterial organisms, you have the polymerase directly recognizing sequence motifs and starting transcription. In eukaryotes, that's not the case, right? You have general transcription factors, most importantly TF2D, transcription factor 2D, which recognizes the sequence elements in this core promoter area and then directs the polymerase to the start site to start transcribing. But the polymerase itself does not interact with the DNA. And just why is this difficult sometimes to find these core promoter region? Simply out of this reason, they can be far away from the translation start site. As I showed in that first cartoon, there can be whole introns, non-coding exons in between the transcription and the translation start site. I would almost say in human exons, that's almost the rule, that you have a lot of non-coding first exons, yes. Again, in yeast, for instance, there are hardly any introns. There's a couple of hundred introns, so there actually, there's usually only one exon to begin with, then it's easier. So this is sort of the look that people, or the idea that people had, or the core promoter works about 5 to 10 years ago. You have these little ellipsoidical things are my rendition of very complicated protein complexes. In this case, these are parts of this TF2D complex. So transcription factor 2D itself is a complex that consists of about a dozen subunits, some of which are shown here. And these individual subunits interact with different sequence motifs. The most famous one is this Tata box binding protein, TBP, that recognizes the Tata box, right? Then you have other subunits that recognize the sequence around the initiator, around the transcription start site. And that was found in Jim Kadonaga's lab at UCSD in the late 90s. You have another sequence element, downstream promoter element, at least in Drosophila very frequent, that recognizes some other components of that TF2D complex. So basically the view there was, well, ideally you should have one of these configurations. You have some sequences where you have a clearly defined Tata box and initiator motif, and they work together. Both of these subunits bind to their respective sequence elements. or you have a different conformation where TVP does not bind, but you have this other element here that binds instead. So you have some alternative conformations, alternative ways how to define a start site. That's pretty much how it stopped there. The problem was that then a little bit later on you started realizing that there are things like tissue-specific components of this complex that recognize different binding sites, or factors that come in to actually replace the TVP protein. So you definitely would not see a Tata box there in the genes that are recognized and transcribed by that complex. So the picture started becoming a bit blurry, and I think that's what we see in general. So the general rule there is that this whole core promoter idea, which you would think is a very universal thing, right? You have a transcription start site that should be more or less defined the same way in different organisms. You have the proteins that are conserved throughout all eukaryotic species, yet how they actually interact with the sequence and recognize these start sites is not always the same. So they're very distinct species-specific features of these core promoter regions, which is quite surprising. At least I found that pretty surprising. At first there was this idea, okay, we have prokaryotes that works different and we have eukaryotes. So if we analyze the sequences or if we build computational models to recognize those transcription start sites, we could use just one for prokaryotes, one for eukaryotes. Fortunately, that's not as easy. So the Tata box, for instance, we saw some pictures yesterday in Eric's talk, actually occurs about 80 nucleotides upstream in yeast, and about 25 nucleotides upstream in other eukaryotes. In other eukaryotes, this is part of the TF2D machinery. It recognizes right around the transcription start site and guides the polymerase right there. So in yeast, that can't work. The spacing is too big. So somehow, the thing must slide down to the transcription initiation site after it actually has recognized the Tata box to start initiation. How that really works, as far as I know, hasn't really been found out yet. A general feature that you see, though, is that this Tata box, which was thought to be the main element, simply because I guess it was found in the first promoters that people looked at and that they could define and find and analyze, this actually turns out to be present sort of as a rule of thumb in about 20% of genes only. Yeah? I would say it comes from both sides at this point. So you have experimental validations of this motif in flies that you mutate individual positions and it decreases the transcription rate. And you simply see that from the bioinformatics side, if you look at flies, there's a very well-conserved motif there. And the recent cage data has basically shown that in mammals, you just have a slight preference for a purine pyrimidine change, and that's it. And also in yeast, the motif is not as strong as in flies. Yes. That is right. I mean, people have done motif finding in this area, and we'll see some examples in Drosophila later. For human, I'm not quite sure, but people have done motif finding of these recently defined larger data sets, and you would think that hopefully that falls out of that, that you see subgroups emerging. In Drosophila, even as I tell you here, well, there's a strong motif, there's not just one, there are at least 2 to 3 variants of this motif that we know of. So yes, there could be even more variants in the human promoters, and simply our experimental data has been so recently of a high quality that the bioinformatics analysis hasn't caught up yet, and there may be stronger defined motifs. That's true. Yeah? We'll get to that later. Somewhat is the answer. It's better than in pretty much all other species at this point, simply because we know more of these motifs in the configuration, but I'll talk about that later. Again, it's work that's basically under progress right now. And yes, the start site is conserved in many cases, but we haven't completed a full analysis yet that I could tell you, okay, for this particular group of genes it's very conserved and for these it isn't, or something like that. And another one. Now it starts, yes. It's slide 6. Hey, we got far. Sorry. It's part of the TF2D complex, so it's in Drosophila TUF 150, 250. It's the same subunit in humans, it's just called differently, so I don't know the name. Right, we'll get there. Okay, another thing that I just want to point out is what people often see in mammalian promoters is this so-called CpG islands. I'm not sure how familiar you are with this concept. It's basically CG dinucleotide rich regions, or relative to the overall CG dinucleotide frequency in the genome. It's related to DNA methylation, and this again is in turn supposed to be related with more open chromatin structure. So this is a phenomenon that's only there in mammalian genomes. You see these regions, these CpG islands, are of a size of a few hundred nucleotides in length, usually 300 to 800 roughly in length, and they sort of overlap the transcription start site and the first exon. It's not an exclusive feature. You see other CpG islands that people think are not related to start sites or to genes, but that may be simply because we don't know what kind of gene there is. It could be a non-coding gene that people simply haven't annotated. But at this point, it looks like about 50 to 60% of protein coding genes that we know of overlap with these CpG islands. And as I said, about 10 to 20% of genes have a Tata box. And these things are quite mutually exclusive. Not completely, but they refer to a large extent to different groups of genes and transcription start sites. Yeah. It's related to DNA methylation, which in turn people think has some interaction with the histone, with histone modifications and the particular histone conformations in particular DNA regions. So yes, it's related likely, or it is actually an epigenetic phenomenon because it refers to DNA methylation, which is epigenetics. But it is defined on a pretty local scale. So it doesn't, a CpG island usually is not a big thing that overlaps, you know, a large part, megabases of a chromosome. It's actually a quite small area. Yeah? Goodness, they are less methylated. An average less methylated, and that's why they have a higher CG frequency, because if they are methylated, the change in the DNA that you have by methylation leads to higher mutation rates, and then you get a depletion of CG where there's more methylation. So less methylation is related to a more open chromatin structure. Yep. Is there? Okay. A change of pure into pyrimidin, or the other way around, I can't remember. That's it. Yep. Yep, exactly. Yep. So there's a tiny bit of information there, but it really sort of, I don't know, whatever, 2-bit range or something in the whole motif, so really not much. Okay. How do people infer this? Michaela talked a little bit about that last week, I think. Time is flying by. Basically, the idea was there was a hard time actually finding these start sites, and that's why we had very few or small gene sets to work with. Because traditionally, experimentally, you would have to sort of try to sequence from somewhere in the middle of the gene and try to get further upstream until you reach the beginning. The reason is that, for instance, the end of the gene is very well defined by poly A tail, so you can use a poly T primer, start sequencing from there, but you don't know what the sequence at the front is, so it's a bit more tricky. And EST sequencing projects usually were biased to the 3' part out of that reason, or used random primers, and then you don't know again what you actually sequence and where that is. And around the mid-late 90s, were several groups that started developing technologies to recognize the 5' cap of the messages and somehow put a marker there that can be attracted, and you can put a linker sequence there so that you can start sequencing from something that you actually know in the other direction. And that's this whole idea of oligo-capped cDNAs. It should lead to full-length sequences. Of course, it's experimental, it's high throughput, so there is quite a lot of noise there, and the initial papers sort of estimated that about 50 to 80% of these individual sequences really reach the start site. But of course, again, that was only done for a few example genes where people knew where it was. It's the cap, the 5' guanosine cap that's put on the transcribed messages. So it's a specifically modified nucleotide at the 5' end of a transcribed message that's basically put on what people think of all protein coding genes, at least. And that's something you can recognize experimentally and then put a generic DNA linker sequence there, and then you can put primers against those linker sequences and start amplifying from that end. So the high-throughput version of that is then known as 5' SAGE or CAGE, again developed by different groups at the same time, done at this point high-throughput in yeast, what Eric talked about yesterday, and in mammals by Piero Carninci's group at RIKEN. There's several million tags of these things out there, and you basically have a high-throughput profile of the sequences of the 5' end of individual messengers in the cell. It's high throughput simply because you basically, it's the same thing like these oligocapsid DNAs. The trick was that you simply only sequence the first 50, 20 nucleotides, put those together, and then amplify those to yield a higher throughput. And now with these high throughput sequencing technologies, people have really ramped this up in the last few months, and I'm sure we'll see quite more comprehensive data on this in the next few months. And the issues that came out of this high-throughput data is sort of, what is actually a transcription start site? Is that actually a site that is defined precisely down to an individual nucleotide by the cell for all the genes, right? Is there something like a 5' end of a gene that has to be at a certain position, or is this more sort of a wobbly idea? Is this a region, right? If I include 10 or 20 nucleotides on each side, does that actually matter in the cell? Probably often it doesn't. What also people started to see is alternative transcription start sites. So things that are clearly defined distinct start sites, you know, separated by 50 or 100 or more nucleotide, so that you see that they are actually used, for instance, in different circumstances. So you see this happening much more than people thought previously, and there are estimates that this goes up to probably more than 50% of the genes. That seems to be similar to alternative splicing, where you change the internal structure of the transcripts. You also have alternative transcription initiation, you have alternative termination, and you see this a lot. And then with this comes, of course, what's then actually a conserved transcription start site? If one genome has two and the other one has one, what is actually meant by conservation here, right? And these are sort of the issues we actually run into once we started looking at this data and see a better picture here. TBP, that's the Tata box binding protein. That is, the proteins are conserved. So you can actually stick some elements, we did this for some of the Drosophila elements that I talk later about, and use the human proteins to transcribe Drosophila messages in vitro, including the motifs from Drosophila. It works fine. Those motifs are simply not used in the other organisms, even though the proteins from those organisms would still recognize and interact with them. So that's kind of the strange thing that we see happening there. Okay, so what do you see from these high throughput pictures? Yeah? Yes, I don't remember that people have done that. So I don't know what would happen there. It's a good question. You take the thing that looks less rich in information and actually see if that could still be recognized, or if you also simply get a more wobbly spread out profile being transcribed from there, but that the efficiency essentially would be the same. It's a good idea. I can tell this to my collaborators and see if they want to do that. Okay, so this sort of gives an overview that's from one of Piero Carninci's papers, what you actually see. You see transcription start sites that are defined and that look like, from the textbook, like we thought we would see. One peak, and yes, a little bit of noise around, but that could be experimental noise, or there's a slight wobble of a few nucleotides on either side. Sometimes happens, definitely doesn't hurt the cell if you have 3-4 nucleotides on either side of the 5' end. Usually doesn't matter. And you see weird things like this here. We have no clue of where the start site is. You see things where it looks like there are alternative start sites that are actually separated by enough room that you could also stick sequence elements in between, and that they could be separately defined by their own sequence elements. And then you see kind of a mixture of everything else, right? So something, yes, there's a more frequent peak, but it stretches out in all kinds of regions here. And, yeah. Yes. No, it is actually much more defined. Mm-hmm. Yes, that is. Yeah. No, that's the work from Fred Dietrich, from my collaborator at Duke. And there's a good number of very well defined start sites, and where you see it really maps to the same location.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I just wanted to say that I think this classification for to a certain extent is fairly arbitrary.
Yes.
I mean, if you really look at it, it's not binary at all.
That's
yes. A little bit, just to have something to look at.
But it's something to look at, something to talk about, something to analyze. You like to categorize and classify things so that it's easier to talk about, right? What you do see is, at least for the mammalian genomes, is that the ones that are well-defined often actually have a nice Tata box in front of them. So if there is a strong sequence motif that we know of, at least for this particular class, that seems to indicate that, yes, this motif helps to precisely define where the transcription start occurs. And for the other genes that have none of the promoter elements that we know of, they have more broader, more spread out profiles. And that sort of makes it a bit questionable, or it's a good question in that sense, if we will be able to find more of these general promoter elements like a Tata box that simply hadn't been found, because if they would direct the transcription initiation to a particular site, we would see more of this, but this seems to be the minority of genes. Mm-hmm. No. So this is, again, I think about 15% of genes. And I'm not sure about the other classes exactly how frequent they were. Yeah? Average number. That, again, unfortunately, is really an arbitrary concept, right? Because it depends on how you set your cutoffs here, how you define the clusters.
Five.
Works well. I could definitely tweak you the parameters that it's four, but it's an arbitrary concept, right? Because people say, oh, they have to have a minimum distance to each other. Each one should be defined by, you know, a reasonable number of tags. To call it alternatively used, you could say, oh, the peaks and their height should be comparable. All these things go in there. So it's tricky to say. Yeah. Well, the question is also what you talk about when you mean alternative start sites, and I've seen, again, both things happening in the paper. So you have things where it's imprecise, or where you have a lot of tags in a very narrow area. And people have seen that even for these things where you just have 5-10 nucleotide differences, you see tissue-specific differences, which one exactly in such a small area is used in which tissue. I wouldn't call this an alternative start site. Some people do. Again, we are still very early in defining this whole thing, because it still defines more or less the same location. And there is no room to say we have different motifs that define this start site versus this. And there has to be a specific distance, you know, at least 50 nucleotides or so, to actually stick other core promoter motifs in there and say, okay, this transcription start site is defined by different sequence elements, right? Yes, that is exactly. Those cases are unequivocally, I think everybody agrees that these are different.
Right, so we can put a lower bound for it.
Yes.
But you cannot really put an upper bound.
Right. You probably know this better, how much you found in human or mouse there. And Drosophila, it's not, it happens, but it's not, you know, 50% of the genes, so I'm not sure. I think we had, alternative first exons. So things where you really see different splicing pattern downstream. So there you really have a separated region, sort of the kings of this example, because, you know, you have a different exon ending here and it's spliced differently than this one. So, yes. Or boundary, I think about 20% is a reasonable estimate.
You said that the Tata box, the tiny one,
yep.
Looks more like the rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
How strong?
I think it is a quite good association as far as I remember, yes.
And what about the other elements?
We'll get to that. So this is all mammalian, right? And I think that for other species, the thing may look quite different if we have more elements that actually are found around the real transcription start site. We have a much stronger defined transcription start site with an information-rich sequence motif. I would expect that for flies, and you know, we're very early of actually getting the data ourselves for flies, I would expect that many more things look like this, simply because there are sequence elements that are in precise spatial distances from the actual map transcription start sites. Yeah. Well, no, there's several things, right, that can go wrong. The one thing is you do attach your linker sequence to an incomplete transcript so that you actually, even if you map it perfectly, transcription initiation didn't happen at exactly that point. Then you can have noise because the things can't be unambiguously mapped and people can deal with that and simply throw it out. Then you can get noise that you map it perfectly, but you map it to the wrong place because of sequencing errors. And lastly, you have that kind of biological noise. And that is, again, twofold, I think. There's simply noise like this that, yeah, you see a few transcripts that vary a little bit. And then I would be, I mean, this is again, right, there's no validation of this, but I wouldn't be worried that this transcript suddenly would be non-functional simply because it's two nucleotides upstream of the start site that they see used. Things like this here, where it spreads out a lot, yes, you will see reproducible tags that are even clustered in specific locations are used or are transcribed in particular tissues, and you don't know yet if that leads to a biological transcript, a biologically meaningful functional thing later on, right? But here people actually look at trying to find just the start sites for the protein coding genes, for the genes that are actually well characterized, right? So I wouldn't worry about that so much the way this analysis is done.
Noise and everything, but compared to other pathologies, I think it's good. I mean, you could say the numbers on how big are the diseases and so on, okay, but if you see these clusters of tags, there are stars there. I don't think there is any doubt whatsoever about that. And for instance, they have to see that when you look at the exons, you get to sort of sometimes you get this little tag all along the exon. And that's when you say, well, that must be incomplete clusters where you pick an incomplete thing from somewhere, so that you have stars somewhere in the middle of the exon. But then they went to the checkpoint and they began to find there are transcripts that start there, but it was just going out of the music. Which would actually surprise me because that was the music of the law. Or experimental approach to the biological law. Right? So I think the question of how much is being meaningful for the cell, that needs to be over.
I think there's a different. I mean, there's this different issue associated with it where you look at tiling arrays and people say, oh, 70% of the genome is transcribed at one stage or another, right? And it's reproducible and it's probably condition specific, yes. Does it have any meaning? We don't know at this point because the transcription occurs in regions where we simply don't have annotation for. We don't know if there is something that later on takes on a function. Here the people really look, we are only looking at upstream of protein coding genes essentially. So I think there are tons of tags that map somewhere in the genome that people just don't call this anything at this point. Yes. There's one recent paper that also came out of the same group where they tried to look whether you could associate specific conditions, so reproducibility, to some of these things basically. And you see, yes, you can see that there are clear significant differences which peaks are preferentially used under which conditions. And that actually could, in a way, those two things could be related, right? And we'll get to one example, goodness, I think later on, that you have things that are, in a way, condition-specific, but they're not so well-defined, not so restricted, that it couldn't happen, and that leading to biological noise, that you see each one happening under all the conditions just with different frequencies, right? So I don't think it's even necessarily a mutually exclusive concept, right? Right.
What about stochasticity and starting to read given individuals?
Not, I don't think in higher eukaryotes like this, right? Yeah. I don't think that has been done for higher eukaryotes. Like in, well, in a way. Yes. That is true. That is true. So if you. Yes. That's exactly these two classes, right? So that you have probably just slippage, a tightly locked protein complex that may change by a base or two on either side where it starts. But more or less starts at one position, and then you have things like this. Yeah, there's no scale on this, unfortunately. I just took that picture from a paper. So this could be 100 nucleotides, 200 nucleotides. Yes. Yes, I managed to get one slide further. But. I think for that we would have to have clearly, you know, very comparable conditions to actually say, oh, this is a comparable number of noise. You know, here this is lumped together from different tissues where they clone different numbers of tags, and so I don't think we can answer that this noise is comparable simply because we would have to repeat the experiment for genes that are transcribed at a similar rate we get the same number of tags under the same condition, and I don't think we have that data. Okay, so yes, as we referred to, yes, this cage data seems to indicate that transcription often in higher eukaryotes is a sloppy event. It's definitely not just one start site that's unequivocally defined precisely at that point. We had this talk last week from Terry Wah's group that actually sort of tells you how this whole thing could originate. For those of you who weren't there, that was basically a simulated evolution of a bacterial promoter where you start with random sequence essentially. You have a selective gene downstream of that small core promoter region, and you amplify, you basically select the pools that confer resistance to a tetracycline or something, or kanamycin, what it was. And then you basically do faulty PCR of the promoters you observe in the resistant clones that are left. And then you stick them back in and you do the several rounds to basically select that the promoter regions should transcribe the selective gene. And what you see happening is that you don't end up with one clearly defined promoter. You exactly end up with this weird mixture of weak motifs where the overall output apparently is strong enough to give you resistance what is selected for. Now, has this, you know, this is only a few rounds. Could it be that eventually one of those weak start sites takes over and defines it, and then you're sort of stuck in a particular conformation, sequence conformation, where you can't get out of anymore, because then you would destroy the whole output of the gene? Probably. I think this is also still very early, but it's very fascinating work where you can see that the evolution itself doesn't drive you to have just one start site. Why should it, right? I mean, as long as the gene gets transcribed and you don't include anything that later could mess up the processing of that transcript, there's not that strong selection there, right? At least not on that level of just the core start sites. What could, for instance, keep start sites in a place is if you have specific interactions with other upstream elements that are only possible at a particular distance, for instance. Then you can't move this thing around without destroying your output. But if you just look at sort of a core promoter region in bacteria, the thing is free to go wherever it wants to. So there is this possibility that often there's probably not a strong pressure to maintain just one precise start site, and that you end up with these sloppy regions which are weakly used, but overall the output of the gene is fine and it leads to what the organism needs. But again, we do see there, and this is this other paper that I referred to earlier, that some of these things are reproducible tissue specific. So it seems that probably it is actually that some of the other transcription factors that define the condition specific activation need at least some specific spacing to work, but that you have sort of this collection of start sites that's used in slightly different and probably overlapping conditions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But if you purify the transcripts that are passed,
mm-hmm.
I mean, you get an RNA population, right?
Yeah.
And what percentage of them at the purification has a pass?
No, you're asking the wrong person.
Yeah.
That, yes.
It's
sort of this one assumption is that protein coding genes get capped on the 5' end and it prevents you from being degraded and chopped off starting on that end. Again, like with polyadenylation on the other end, you see a large number of transcripts that are, for instance, not polyadenylated, right? Yeah.
Yeah. That it's very specific, because I think the thing that binds the cap actually protects starting the mRNA from being digested.
Yeah.
But we see plenty of stuff in there that I don't think is capped.
What makes you think it's not capped?
That's what I'm
without giving away too much, what?
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering. They followed up on with another technique.
You could have other. I mean, you could.
There are other reasons why you can stop.
Yes. For instance, you could have. I mean, you can have what?
Okay, so, but how would you validate in the competitor?
Well, that comes from the textbook idea of the central dogma, what happens to transcripts, right?
No, no,
and we see that that central dogma is really not
but,
that...
But what I have a problem with is when you open
yep,
the cell,
exactly.
You have the RNA population, and then yep. you use some technique to purify the stuff that's capped, but there is no way that any of these purifications are going to happen. You can't purify a protein out of the cell, you can't purify anything out of the cell.
So they're probably... There are probably two things, right, that can happen. We can have transcripts that simply weren't capped and we don't find them. And another peak could easily arise, but then you would actually see a sharp peak if you have, for instance, interactions with double-stranded RNA and the thing was cleaved, right? Then, but again, then you wouldn't have, these things wouldn't be capped. Would they be part of this library? I don't know how specific that is, whether they would be able to pick that up. I don't think it should be a large fraction of it. Okay. Okay. Yes. Yeah. Okay. So what people do here. So the first library with this large-scale library for these cap-trap transcripts was actually done from this Recon group for the Drosophila Genome Project where I worked at the time. And even though it wasn't as high throughput like this 5' stage stuff later on, we could use this to infer start sites. And at that point, it was the largest collection of semi-validated start sites in a given genome. We had 250,000 5' EST sequences that were generated by this particular method. And as I said, we don't believe in one particular instance here. For these more low-throughput versions, we had basically requirements that, you know, these things should come from spliced transcripts because we're looking at whole ESTs, so we could see that, yes, there was some processing later on, and we only used those that were later on processed. They clustered together within a specific sequence window because we still thought, of course, that you will have mostly transcription occurring at a particular point and that you have a minimum number that actually falls in such a small window. And when we went back and looked at the one database of non-promoters, experimentally validated non-promoters at the time in Drosophila, one thing to do to see whether those things match up with the expectation was simply to see whether these sequence motifs that people knew of were actually present in a comparable fraction of these transcripts or of these inferred transcription start sites. And you could see that this was the case for the initiator. This is the definition that was used by the people that actually set up this database. And you could see that the fraction, two-thirds of the genes, was roughly comparable. What you could see, though, is that the Tata box frequency was much lower. And this even allows for quite a large range, which is probably not functional for all these motifs anymore. But that's the way it was defined. That's how we compared those two sets. And you could see that the expected motifs, that was sort of one of the first indications that this well-known motif that people thought is more or less a canonical rule, how a start set is defined, was actually not there all the time. So instead, we applied what Eric told you about yesterday. We ran MEME on these data sets. And now this was a very easy task in a way, because we only looked at 100 nucleotide-long sequences. So finding the local optima in these sequences is actually fairly easy. 100 nucleotide sequences and 2,000 of them. So we ran for quite a while because you're not, these programs are not set up really to deal with such large data sets. Often if you look at co-regulated genes, you're not expecting to see 2,000 genes co-regulated. But of course for co-promoter motifs, you would expect that a large fraction of these sequences do have particular sequence motifs. And this is sort of, we ran this basically to generate the top 10 motifs in here. And yes, some of them corresponded to the Tata box, to the initiator site, to canonical sites of transcription factors that probably just hang out close to the core promoter, to this other non-motif downstream promoter element, to another motif which was downstream, and some other things that we really don't quite know yet what they are. Most important part that I want to draw attention to are these two motifs here probably. This was actually shown at the same time in a biochemistry lab that this was an interaction partner of one of the proteins that replaces this TBP component. So TBP gets kicked out, you put TRF2 in its place, TRF2 interacts with this DRE factor, and that recognizes this motif. So TRF2 doesn't even recognize DNA directly. So it's an even more indirect way of actually finding the transcription initiation site. But it made sense to find this thing enriched in core promoter regions. Motif 1, we still have no idea what it is, and it's the most frequent core promoter motif in all Drosophila sequences. That is a non-transcription factor in Drosophila. There are other abbreviations in other species. So in Drosophila, it's the DNA replication-related element, which was named because the first genes they found with this thing had something to do with DNA replication. The overall set has absolutely no enrichment for DNA replication whatsoever. So we should probably change the name of this thing at some point, but now it's stuck, right? And you could see these are basically, as we said, MIM optimizes basically a log likelihood function when it finds these motifs. But you can assign, once you have found a motif, you can assign an E value or a P value to what you find there, simply whether the sequence motif that you find with this given sequence composition conservation in the set of sequences of that given length and composition is what you would expect by random or is it not random. It's kind of not clear how this is derived. They've never published this, but there's some other papers of related groups where you can get some rough idea how they probably come up with this number. Yep. We'll get to that question. The simple answer is usually they don't occur by themselves, but in pairs. So they form a simple cis-regulatory module consisting of two elements, and then this is not so random anymore. It's very rare. Oh, you do see some promoters where at this point we only find one of these sequence elements, but often they're defined by, you know, Tata box plus initiator in the right distance. And this thing together actually gives you quite good specificity. So here were the positional preferences of these motifs, and as you expect, you see the Tata box in the right distance upstream, the initiator motif around position 0, and then these two downstream motifs around position plus 25. You also see that this motif 1 does have some weak preference around the third site, but not as strongly as these other previously known motifs. This is all Drosophila now. Yeah. The Tata box is this here. And this was, I think, number 3 in the list that we had. Yeah. Okay. We are fortunate enough that we grabbed the attention of some of the biochemists that work on this, that actually did the hardcore studies of validating this one thing that showed a clear positional preference, the last thing here, motif 10, but wasn't known before. They went in and did really the whole thing on several example promoters that have that. If you do specific mutations, if you take specific subparts of that motif and stick it in, when do you see the strongest activation? So basically try to define the exact extent of that motif, because MIM will give you some answer, but it doesn't mean that the whole extent that you get, the motif size, is actually the functional motif. But it actually frequently happens that you probably either pick up some spurious, or what frequently actually happens is that you get a subset of genes that actually, of the total number that have this motif, but that there's some sort of preference on the flanks, and so you get a stronger overall score of whatever function you optimize if you just narrow in on that subset. So often you get motifs that are actually too long. So they did the mutational studies and validated which part of that motif actually was functional, moved this around, tested this in cooperation with all the other known core factors and all that, and established that this is really an element where the TF2D complex binds to, even though they never went as far to show which part of it actually binds there. This shows you some just numbers of co-occurrence motifs. And for instance, these downstream motifs very frequently co-occur with the initiator. And this is, you know, this is all random defined, that you set one particular cutoff for these weight matrix matches, and then say, okay, at these comparable cutoffs for the motifs, how often do I see this occurring together? The numbers could be higher if, you know, you set the cutoff to stringent, for instance. You also see this motif 1-6 co-occurrence very frequently, and this is something that we just followed up bioinformatically, and you see that the motif 6-1 pair actually has a similar spacing that the Tata box initiator pair, and they occur preferentially in promoters that do not have Tata boxes or initiators. So it seems to be an alternative way to define the start site, but as I said, it still hasn't been experimentally validated what this thing does. There have been a number of follow-up papers from using the same data set that we collected, and everybody finds this as the strongest core cis-regulatory component, and nobody knows what this thing actually does. So that's, I still find that quite interesting. It doesn't seem to be, we haven't looked carefully, it doesn't seem to be widely present in, again, in the human genome. People have looked, and there are some promoters that have these downstream promoter elements. With this one, people haven't had much luck yet. So. Kind of, yes. Yeah, but you have this G preference here, which Tata usually doesn't have. So it's really, there's not much overlap. If you set the thresholds, I actually checked that. If you set the thresholds the way, that was one way why we, this is probably too stringent, because you want to set it in a way that you don't get overlapping results where you just get basically the same location and claim it's two different motifs. So these are non-overlapping occurrences in terms of their position. Co-occurrence in the same promoter, but non-overlapping in their actual position.
So have you tried to look at
We checked at the time, you know, whatever databases, JustPAR and TransFAC is out there, but there was no overlap to this, no. Yeah? Not the energy per se. So they have done this with this MTE where you take the wild type promoter and then mutate and see how much there's a transcription rate in vitro drop. So for MTE, people have done this. For DPE, people have done this, but not for this particular motif combination. Okay, so this is sort of the summary of what we see there, and that gives you an idea of how these things could, at least in this one organism of fly, be defined, and that's simply by a large number of combination, how you can actually define a start site. So about 85% of the transcription start sites in our data set have at least one of these motifs in the right preferred distance or present in the core promoter region. So that tells us that we're not too far away, that there are probably some of these motifs still lacking, but that overall, at least for flies, the sequence features actually seem to be enough to characterize start sites. And that's a bit different, as I said, that's why I made this long introduction to the mammalian organisms, because we don't see this happening for mammalian genomes. People try to find core promoter motifs like this in mammalian organisms, and so far they haven't had that much luck with that yet. Okay. And these could be mutually exclusive. So for instance, for the Tata box and initiator pair versus initiator DPE, it can only be one of them binding at the same time. So there people know the complex of TF2D and some of the subcomponents, and it's either the one binding or the other, but it doesn't make a difference. If you stick all of them in there, it doesn't change the transcriptional output. Okay, so this is something I worked on. That's interesting. Okay, those slides got messed up. So there's a long history of how to actually find those things computationally, right? So this was actually one, when people talked about promoter recognition in the 90s, they usually meant this kind of stuff, because that was the only data you had. You didn't have enough data on enhancers and to try to define specific regulatory sequences like early Drosophila enhancers. So people tried to find these start sites in these proximal promoter regions. There were a number of approaches that either tried to put weight matrix sits together in a particular way, or use neural networks to try to find these things, or use what's called content-based or similar, the overall oligonucleotide statistics in that region, and try to pick up these things. And They weren't that successful with this, but that's not that surprising if you see how loosely defined start sites are actually at this point, right? If these things are all over the place and you have some sort of randomly defined gold standard by the one start site that was mapped by some experimentalist, and now you find something that is, you know, 200 nucleotides away, it probably wasn't counted as that you recognized the start site there. But if transcription happens all over the place, then probably, you know, the low quality of the predictors, how people call it, this is simply due to that the biology just simply didn't work how people thought it did. Later on, you know, people use probabilistic models, hidden Markov models, as generative probabilistic approaches, or support vector machines and more the discriminative classification framework. And you do get to see some improvements, especially with this high throughput data, have larger data sets, how that works. And the approaches were also slightly different if people really just focused on the transcription start sites and say, this is what the cell recognizes, this is somehow how the start of a gene is defined, and I only use the information in this core promoter region or in the proximal promoter region. And then other people that sort of said, oh, we just want to have a correct annotation, we don't care how the biology works. There are a lot of people out there like that. And just say, oh, we just try to integrate this with other gene finding computational approaches because that limits where we're actually looking, right? You know the coding region, yes, you have non-coding exons and introns in between the translation and the transcription start site, but of course limiting to looking in some region upstream of the translation start site helps it to find transcription start site, obviously. I don't think it's the greatest idea because we basically exclude everything else that could be transcribed and, for instance, non-coding, right? But there are different flavors to these things. The one particular one that I was working on was called MEC Promoter because there are Markov chain models and some of the components. I didn't even come up with this name, but it kind of stuck. What the heck? I didn't get sued so far for infringement by an unnamed company. And the way this works is basically straight up classification. You have probabilistic sequence models in this particular thing, which is in this case, it's called a generalized hidden Markov model that models basically subregions and motifs in this core promoter region and a particular distance to each other. It's similar to the methods that people later on used for cis-regulatory module identification. It's essentially the same computational techniques, just that the structure here is a bit easier and better defined in what these elements actually are and how they co-occur. Right? It's not this, oh, I think there could be 10 transcription starts factors and then don't know which and how many of them. If you find something, it's this pair in that particular distance, right? But of course, fewer hits, right? It's defined by two elements only, and these cis-regulatory modules have 10, 20 binding sites in there, so that makes it harder to actually accurately predict it because the overall information content in the sequence window you're looking at is less. And then you contrast your promoter model with alternative models, basically for coding and for non-coding non-regulatory sequences. In this case, you know, introns are usually taken. You have a base classifier or something else in the end, and that basically makes predictions of whether a particular sequence window has a transcription start site in it or not. And of course, that was sort of the early approach. And then after you have a collection of these motifs and you know that specific combinations co-occur with each other and don't seem to occur all together at the same time, it makes sense to actually split these things up, right? So later on, just as a follow-up and to follow up and see if this actually really works and does it help you to define this, just in silico, in the computational models, they basically initialized this total data set of 2,000 promoters in overlapping initial partitions that are defined by the presence of these motifs, and then basically had initially six different promoter models that were given the task to actually just classify the different promoter sequences. So you have sort of a decision-supervised clustering procedure that goes through several rounds and refines these overlapping partitions, and you can check, for instance, are these clusters stable? If I initialize this promoter set with Tata box promoters and this one with DPE promoters, and I ask whether the computer can decide between them, distinguish between them, that's probably also a good indication that we have enough sequence information in there. And you can do this. This is shown here. So if you start with an initial set and you, which with overlapping partitions, and then you force the computer to make decisions, and you do this in several rounds of decision-supervised learning, then you end up with something like this here, where you see that, yes, a fraction of the initial set is still there, and then we have some promoters added to the set where we didn't make an initial call that it contains a particular promoter configuration, element configuration, and then also some things from other groups get reclassified. So things that were initially assigned to a different partition actually end up in this partition. But overall, you can see that these things are reasonably stable. The most unstable class is where you say, oh, it's just an initiator motif, because none of the other motifs actually matches your cutoff. But that you're actually left with hardly anything in there afterwards tells you that probably your cutoff was simply too stringent, and that after all, many of these things simply contain a second weaker motif that you just didn't call with your particular weight matrix cutoff. And that seems to make sense. So you stick this into this huge model, right? So now you have a generalized hidden Markov model with lots of separate parallel submodels for initiator DPE or Tata box initiator or this motif 1, motif 6, motif 1 pair, and then run on this, and then you can, let's get back to this later, simply see how much better are you doing. So you have some sort of data set that you believe in. That's really the difficult business at this point. I wouldn't even try to do this in mammalian genomes anymore with all this weird transcription that occurs anywhere. These were 92 promoters that were of reasonably high quality, not, you know, five prime race or something validated as much, but that we believed in were relatively close to the start site. And you can see how many do you recover and how many of the, what's the fraction of the total predictions that corresponds to some things in your set. And so you see, when I did this with one model here, you get, for instance, 50% success rate that you find 50% of the promoters in these larger sequence regions when you scan through them. And 40% of those predictions corresponded to promoters in your set. 60% are additional predictions that you don't know if they're false positives. So are there alternative start sites or what this is? At this point, we call them false positives. I think many of those things probably would work if you just stick them upstream of a reporter gene. The computer tells you these are not worse than any of these other promoters that are known. So probably this thing could work by itself. If it used in the cell, that's a different question. This was another approach that was based on support vector machines with essentially comparable success, but also just lumped everything in one big bucket. And then if you start splitting these things up, then especially for subgroups, so when you set your threshold very stringent, you see that your false positive rate actually drops quite a lot. So yes, it seems that we are actually closer to modeling the real biology, essentially. Okay. Yep. So.
So, I guess this is kind of what I'm looking at. So, are there any prospects for real mechanistic modeling? You know, the molecules of all are doing nearly the same computation.
Right. Well, that's why I'm telling you about this, right?
So, I mean, are there no prospects for being able to understand this?
I think the problem, but that's really just, you know, wild speculation. I think the problem you would run into is that this whole TF2D complex, which essentially recognizes many of those core promoter motifs, is that it's a huge complex, right? So you would make assumptions. You could probably just take TBP and see how that binds to the Tata box. I think that has been done. At least the structure is solved to bound and unbound DNA. I'm not sure if people really do, you know, energy calculations and dissociation constants or things like that. So I'm not sure how far along or how, if people are actually working on this.
So I think this is a little restriction, but in the end, the model is all fitted and so on. So are the things that the precise combinations of motifs that you have to get and their spacing, are they pretty fixed or are they pretty flexible? So, I mean, like in your Markov model, you know, like, you know, elements and spaces, and it's basically, they all look the same, or is it still very large within a collapsed area of spaces?
There is definitely a variable spacer. it looks, for instance, that these downstream promoter motifs are more restricted in terms of their spacing than the Tata box on the other end. I know that I think Boris Lenhard looked at this, right, in one of his papers when they analyzed the mammalian data, just this Tata box subset, that you see real correlation of the spacing and how efficiently it is transcribed. Just looking at the, taking the SAGE data for given and saying that this is a proxy of transcription efficiency. So there are clear correlations of how distant the Tata box is and how many of those tags you actually observe. So the spacing is quite restricted. Yeah.
What they get often is that there's a major peak, and then you get some starts also one day to the left or right of it.
Yeah.
And basically,
right.
The major peak tends to be at the place that is the sort of
canonical, yes.
Tata,
right.
And then you get a little bit longer.
Right. So the spacing is relatively restricted. I wouldn't say it's restricted to just one nucleotide or particular, just one distance. It seems to be still in a somewhat flexible range, but not very large, right? So this is really on the order of like allowing for a wobble of 5 nucleotides or something like that. Okay. So I want to, let's see how far we get today. this is just work that's basically in progress here, and I just want to throw out some things that we observe and where I think this is going and what kind of data we have to answer these questions. So we already said that we have a large fraction of genes that has more than one transcription start site. And as I said before, I mean that these are really distinctly spaced start site or in the extreme case, even alternative first exon, so that it's clear it's really doing something different. Why would you want these things? Well, there's a number of reasons why the cell would want alternative start sites. The one thing is, it could be that it interacts with different proximal promoters or enhancer regions. So that simply the start site, one start site interacts with the liver enhancer and the other one with a muscle enhancer. And the easiest way to sort of tease these things apart and make sure it works is basically by having more than one start site there, right? You could also, in the extreme case, of course, generate alternative translation start sites if your transcription start sites is downstream of the first ATG that's used to actually generate a protein for this particular locus. Or you could put alternative 5' UTRs there, which could have other post-transcriptionally regulatory roles, right? So there's a reason why this could happen in biology, and where there's a reason to have alternative start sites. And the alternative thing is that, well, it just so happened, like in Terry Wah's experiment, that we just ended up with several of them and the cell is happy as it is, right? We know of examples where there is really a reason to do this, and I think if anybody wants to look into this, the protocadherin genes, I think, is a good example where you have tons of alternative start sites that basically generate a vast difference of functional protein products later on. In turn, and sort of related to this concept a little bit, do alternative start sites simply arise because of just random drift in the sequence and you get stuck, you just have a new motif arising and the cell is happy and suddenly you have a second start site. If the core promoter is just there to define it, then yes, probably in many cases you would expect that that happens, right? The things turn over, you change the position, or you probably even change the particular motif and how this is defined, right? So is it a Tata box promoter or a DPE promoter? But if transcription start sites, or in particular alternative start sites, provide some context information, for instance, which enhancer you can interact with, then this would be a different story and we would expect that these things cannot turn over as easily, right? So this is sort of what we're stuck with dealing. So the one scenario would be that we say, oh yeah, these things are always conserved. There's some studies that I just want to point out where people have started looking at this. This is one paper where they just took experimentally some filtered subset of what's called experimentally validated start site in human or in mouse, and then check in the whole genome alignments, human, found thing in human, what's the sequence conservation mouse at that spot or vice versa. So these are usually things where you don't have a start site which is defined for both species, but you only have it in one, and then you look what does the sequence at that locus in whole genome alignments tells you in the other species. And you do see on average that, yeah, there is a conservation around the plus one position. But if you look at the scale here, it is strong, but it's not, you know, outstanding, crazily different. It's sort of a 10-15% sequence conservation bias at that peaks at that particular position. But this is averaged over, you know, I think 8,000 or something like this start sites. Yes.
Right?
Oh, yes.
So everything there is
yeah.
more conserved.
Exactly. Even this here is already more conserved, right? So that's the thing. It is an average profile. The other picture would be, well, do you see turnover transcription start sites? And that's from Martin Frith's paper from last year. You see four example genes in here. The upper panel is mouse, the lower panel is human, and then the cage distribution, these tag distributions around the start sites. And you can see that for some things, yep, you have a peak in human, you have a peak in mouse, and it's pretty much at the same spot. And then you have things where you have a peak in mouse and, well, kind of a region in human, but they're clearly at different positions, and you don't really see any transcriptional initiation occurring at the other side. So there seems to be a turnover there. The problem... That is the one problem, I think, why this is sort of a good first stab at it, but a little bit lead. It's simply that many of the recon corresponding conditions in human versus mouse. There are only like two or three libraries, I think, when I looked at it, that you would call, yeah, it's kind of a corresponding tissue, like adult liver. Probably is not that much different. But even there, right? It's like, yeah. It was, I think that was one of the ones where there was at least something, because all the other conditions are different, right? So you couldn't really compare that. So in a way, well, there's a lot of alternative splicing in liver, so who knows? It's an important organ, we all know that, right? Brain and liver, both very important. Yes. That is... part of the thing we deal with developmental time stages in human. No, I don't think we'll get that. But you see sort of intermediary products, and that's probably what's nice. So here's the extreme case where you don't really know what's going on. These are sort of overlapping things with different frequencies, but they're kind of in the same region still. But then you have things where you have two start sites, and one is used frequently in mouse, and one is used frequently in human, right? And this could be at this, in their case, they concluded from this that this is basically turnover. If the conditions are equivalent, this is sort of turnover seen in progress, right? That you had in the ancestor two locations which looked good as start sites, and going towards human, this one got stuck, and going towards mouse, this one got stuck. And the other ones are then allowed to decay, and that's why we see fewer tags from there. And essentially, if we wait a few hundred million years more, we will end up at this picture at some point, right? If we get the appropriate species, you could also, for instance, see if you know the rat profile, how does that look, right? Is that close to the mouse one? Then you would probably see this as additional evidence for that. If it's more than three slides back, it's not allowed anymore. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep. Yes, there's definitely the conformation and how sort of well-defined these motifs are have an influence on the overall transcriptional output. And in fact, this group in San Diego that we collaborate sort of actually generated what they call a super core promoter a few months ago, where they stuck all kinds of elements from even different species together, and now they have the core promoter with the highest ever observed transcriptional output. Which makes biologists happy, because there, you know, if you want to report a gene, you just want to make sure the thing works, well, that's what you stick upstream now, and that's what you use. And it has a Tata box, it has an MTE, it has a DPE, it has even some other element that we don't know what it does. It's like all together fused in this one sequence, and it works great. It has like way, like people use CMV promoters before, cytomegalovirus. That's like a dwarf against this thing, right? So yes, there is actually, there's a correlation. You see. Yeah. The problem, of course, how that gets confounded is that the core promoter is assisted by all these tissue-specific elements, right? So if you do this in vitro with just the core promoter, you see differences. How that correlates with what other elements essentially define that the transcript gets activated in this particular condition, that's a messier business. But this is something, yes, that I think we could probably start looking at and see how well is that actually defined. Do you see some global tendencies? Do you see some levels, if the Tata box is really weakly defined, do you see some overall tendencies in the expression profiles versus the ones that have a really well-defined motif there?
What you said is actually quite interesting, right? Because if you said that it's not like I sometimes heard that, well, you don't seem to bind too strongly to polymerase, you then can't use it anymore. What you seem to suggest is you stick it as many of these good binding sites together.
Yeah. But that's the difference between prokaryotic and eukaryotic, though, right? So I think from Terry Waugh's talk, for prokaryotes, that's probably true, because there the polymerase itself binds there. Here, it's the auxiliary factors, TF2D, which binds, but the polymerase just recognizes that the complex is sitting at that site.
And does it actually leave that stuff behind when it starts activating?
Okay, that's a good point. So there are these, I mean, especially in bacteria, these holoenzymes, and you do see that in eukaryotes, too, that they drag elements from the general machinery with them, but I don't think there's an ultimate word out there. If that is just something that happens, for instance, if it's not that well defined and it can leave, or would it actually really hinder the whole thing and reduce the transcription rates if it's too well defined? I don't think people have looked into that. But yeah, the big difference really is that between prokaryotes, yeah, you're really stuck, right? And with eukaryotes, you have this additional layer where it's indirect. Okay. We went back to this data set I talked to you about, and there's some new data that came in the last 5 years, obviously, and just wanted to see if we can actually find alternative transcription start sites in that data. So that's not high-throughput stage data. It's 5' capped, but EST, not as high-throughput. And we have two Recon libraries here where we get basically whole embryonic data from different stages, head from different stages, and now we can sort of see which start sites are actually used in those two libraries. And actually, at least for those two libraries, you can tease that apart and also define alternative start sites. And you see these kind of fractions, which are, you know, on the lower level because we don't have high throughput data yet. But you see that, you know, you have, of course, obviously different genes that get activated, but also different start sites that are used under different tissues. You can even tell this from these low throughput but high-quality data. For instance, for this particular gene, we have four start sites defined. This is the tag frequency at the exact site, not in the overall cluster. And you see that two of them are used in head, one of them is used in testes, and there's no overlap, really, in the use of that start site between the two different libraries. So that's kind of nice. So it looks really, for Drosophila, I think we have a cleaner picture to look at. One nice example is this gene. This is all in embryonic. You know, most of it is expressed during embryo development. You have six start sites for this gene here. We have five where we observe tags in the embryo library. We can actually go now to tiling data that's been published for Drosophila in two-hour time intervals and see when these start sites are actually used at a particular stage. And here also you see that, you know, this is basically experiment, which is a two-hour window, so this would be from hour 2 to 6, basically, this here in development. You see that different start sites are used at different stages in development, and then the other stages they're off, even though the overall gene is expressed all the time. So you see things like that happening. We don't really know yet why is this setup so complicated. Does it more follow the Terry Waugh model that, you know, oh, the gene just ended up this way and it gets the right output at the right time? Because yes, they are activated under different conditions here, or is there also, you know, crosstalk with different enhancers, and why you would actually need such a complicated arrangement? Pardon? Yes, so this is one of the cases where you have an alternative first exons. Yeah. So there are some simulations by Michael Lynch's group, in silico simulations, and they have basically, he has a very simplified model of what how a transcription start site is defined, but basically simulated and said you can end up, because people had this argument before, if you have a long UTR, there's probably something meaningful in there. So if you have a long distance between the transcription and translation start site, and he found that there's enough chance in the genomes that we look at that this profile that we see can essentially arise from chance. If the only thing you want to define is the start site, if it doesn't interact with anything else and the only thing is to direct initiation to a particular region, you see enough turnover that can happen that you could end up with very long UTRs. Well, it is related to that, because if it just arises by chance, that tells you even though you have these things, well, they are. Well, that's the conclusion that he basically made, is, well, you end up with this profile randomly, but that doesn't mean that afterwards the cell can't acquire a particular motif, as you said, for transcription, translation start site recognition, for instance, or obstruction or degradation or something like that. And, I mean, there are some elements known in 5' UTRs that affect that. And again, what we do here is the first step, that you get a compendium and then hopefully analyze for the known things of if there are actually differences like that. But this is all still very early. And as usual, you'll probably end up with a mix of everything, right? That for some things it doesn't matter, and for others, yes, there's something in there now why you want these alternative UTRs or alternative start sites then eventually. Yeah. There are some that are known. There's a ribosomal motif, for instance, in Drosophila in the 5' UTR that is common to ribosomal genes. And there's nothing to do with transcription yet. Some other groups analyzed this just as a follow-up, just to complete this whole story. So you can see that this was where they refer to our analysis from before, and you see they find some variants of initiators or DPEs, and they find basically one new motif also in core promoter regions, which is somewhat frequent, not as frequent as the initiator, obviously, but that we probably missed at the time when we did the analysis, and that could also have regulatory function in the core promoter. We're not completely done with this, but I think for Drosophila, we're getting at least to a reasonably close picture here. This is just, unfortunately, though, I think they shot themselves in the foot when they were doing this, because they basically took the whole sequence set of annotated 5' ends as they were in the database without any filters, 10,000 genes. And we know that there's a lot of garbage and incomplete transcripts in there. So this is actually from a different paper where they just looked at how relatively frequently is the canonical initiator, short initiator motif. So you have different extensions and different variants, but this is really sort of a minimum. And this is what it was in our set, the relative frequency. And then if you take a longer set from the database, well, you see this dropping quite a bit. And I don't think this is due that there is, the initiator is not as frequent. I think, well, you probably should have done some quality check on your data. And then if you analyze, of course, these data sets where half of it is complete junk, then you won't find that much new, unfortunately. Yes. This is the percentage is related. The numbers are the absolute numbers. And here is the percentage is the same scale on the plot. Yeah, but basically to half. I mean, it always depends how you define your motif, and do you just look at the exact position, or do you allow for a wobble or something like that? But no, unfortunately, they still said, "Oh yeah, we still detect it, and let's analyze it now." And that was a bit strange, I think. But finding new motifs and things, and then you don't find that much new. It's not that surprising, right? But anyway, that's just a side point. So, oops, to finish this up, so these core promoters are quite variable. We have a diverse set of these different core promoter modules, which are sort of little tiny cis-regulatory modules consisting of basically just two elements. We do see new elements, at least in FLY, that where we see how transcription start sites can be defined in a eukaryote. And the next thing, of course, is now to go and see why you actually do have different elements. Why is it not just a Tata box all the time? What kind of extra things and extra opportunities do you get if you have the flexibility of defining a start site with different sequence motifs? And people know of specific, for instance, enhancer transcription factor interaction. So that actually solves this one question that came sometime last week, where how does the enhancer know which gene it goes to? Well, sometimes the core promoter actually tells it. It can only interact with the Tata box containing core promoter and not with the one on the other side, which contains a DPE. So there are things like this out there. We just don't know yet how frequent they are. And the computational promoter recognition works quite well for Drosophila, but just for Drosophila because of that reason that we actually know what are the sequence elements that have a reasonable information content and help us to find these things. And for other genomes, that is still quite a bit trickier. And then, well, this is what pretty much the whole community is probably working on currently, the conservation, what do these alternative TSSs mean, how are these things defined, how they do they evolve over time. Okay, so this was part one of the talk. Okay, so the second here is somewhat related, but actually deals with a more theoretical thing. And it's motivated by that the issues that we got stuck with when we analyzed the core promoter regions, and we want to look across species now and actually see whether these things are conserved or do they actually have turnover and does the motif configuration change or is it a stable thing, right? And what we run into then, of course, if you do cross-species analysis, is that you want to align your sequences to compare if they're actually conserved. And that quickly runs into, or you quickly run into problems there because how do we know how well those algorithms actually do? Most multiple sequence alignment algorithms are developed for coding region alignments and have assumptions in them, for instance, collinearity of sequence, most of them, that assume that you're dealing with coding sequence types of evolution, of evolutionary changes in your sequence. And so the idea was, how can we actually get data sets that show some turnover or changes in the sequence, what we would probably see in biological real sequence data, and then being able to tell, for instance, for a particular conformation, how often would you expect these things, the sequence to change, that, for instance, a Tata box disappears and a DPE appears, how often can that actually happen if you want to keep the initiator in the middle in place, things like this, questions like this. Do we get some sort of bottom line ideas of what's your null assumption, how often could this happen? And that should also help us if we have sequence sets like this to actually assess how well the algorithms do for multiple sequence alignments and what we can expect, how good the alignments actually are. So, well, this is not quite a new thing. People have done sort of in silico studies of sequence evolution and of non-coding sequence evolution. Manolis Dermitsakis, for instance, Andy Clark's group has done studies in that direction. But in a way, for pretty much all these things, you sort of had this assumption that transcription factors are conservation islands, and then you have two different evolutionary models. One thing for the stuff around it, and that changes. And the transcription factor itself is under different restrictions, so we have different substitution rates for the individual positions in the transcription factor. So you had assumptions like this for large-scale studies, or then really small-scale studies where people looked at a handful of genes and said, oh, how often do we see particular, you know, transcription factor binding sites between those different species, and do they correspond to each other, or do we think there's turnover? So what we set out to do is basically write a simulator which allows you to start from a random promoter-like looking sequence with the background higher order Markov model, for instance, and then you choose particular restrictions on that sequence. So you stick binding sites in there, for instance, Tata box or DPE or other transcription factor binding sites, and you specify restrictions on them, a particular distance that they have to obey, a particular threshold of, for instance, a weight matrix match, and it can't get lower than that, things like this. And then you just have one model, like one substitution model that just runs everywhere, and you only accept changes that actually keep those constraints in place. And that actually allows you to simulate turnover, right? Because if you have a good binding site somewhere here, and by random mutations you can have one here, and it's still in your, for instance, specified maximum distance of the transcription start site, well then this site can disappear and you can get stuck with this site in terms of your evolution of, of your simulation of evolution. And already the first questions.
You can have a Markov model for the motor. Mm-hmm. They're also generate. Yeah. So
yes. No, actually not.
So why not?
Because the hidden Markov model itself doesn't have any evolutionary assumption, right?
Yeah, right.
We start. Yes, you could probably go. Yes. You could probably do that as well, to basically say, yeah, you generate this with a phylogenetic HMM with has specific parameters, and you would allow these things to change. But again, there, you actually, for instance, often specify. Well, it depends how you set up your model then, if you allow for rearrangement of sites or things like that. Right, if you would expect the things to stay in the same order, can they get scrambled, can the number change, and these things. So you could probably set something similar up and actually use some kind of phylogenetic HMM to generate this data set.
So I think one rate is what?
Substitution rate, substitution model.
Insertions and deletions?
No, I do, yes, insertions and deletions as well, just not that you have, you know, random background neutral substitution rate and highly restricted substitution rates within the binding sites.
You're going to basically have to decide on the model of the model, what rate, the curve, what length, allow regions to swap upside down, inside out, right?
So, I mean, that's all, see, this is basically, what I see this is not a realistic model, but actually something that you can hopefully play around with and then generate data sets that allow for these things or don't allow for these things and so forth. So we have an indel model, for instance, with a geometric length distribution and with a particular substitution versus indel rate ratio, which is frequently used for these other simulators. Yeah, exactly. So we're way, way behind this, right? This is just a theoretical exercise to generate data sets that obey specific restrictions. We could specify different rate heterogeneity, so that overall in broad regions you have, that you have slightly different rates in broad regions and that some are a bit more restricted than others. But yes, I mean, this is something that other people have seen as well, that you have, Eric Davidson mentioned this at one point, that basically the substitution rates within those enhancers are actually indistinguishable from other supposedly neutral regions, and the only thing where you see real difference is actually in the indel rate, right? So, yes, the indel rate is lower in the enhancer regions. So this is, again, like, I mean, you see, that's exactly why I want to throw this thing out. It's basically just for biologists to say, like, okay, if you play around with this, do we arrive at similar sequence scenarios than we actually see in reality, or what kind of parameters would we need to set that we arrive at similar results than what we actually see happening in the species, right? Because I think by now, you see all different things, and we don't really know yet what to make of it and how these things actually really evolve. So this is one particular idea, and basically the idea here is that the overall conformation number, presence, distance of sites within the region is the same. So similar to, you know, the enhancer regions that Stephen talked about, but you could basically, or Marty talked about, but basically the relative order of the sites or these things could actually change. So in the end, the evolutionary pressure is on the output and not on the actual sequence. Now you have an idea of how the output works and how those things are arranged, and that's what you have to put in here. But of course, we don't know this, unless for an exception for a handful of cases. What are really the rules, and how could you really specify that?
Right. I guess my question was, it seems to me there are two things, right?
Yeah.
One is, what does selection care about?
Mm-hmm.
And that is precisely, as you say, it might be something relatively final output from the motor area, and then things may shift around this and that.
Yeah.
But the other thing is, what is actually the moveset in evolution? You know, what are the genetic moves that are occurring at what time of frame?
Yeah.
And both of these things determine how the evolution looks from one to the next.
Yep.
And I think both of them we really don't know how to do. Right? Not just the first one, the second one too. We really don't have much of a clue of what sort of moves are.
So you mean, and with moves you mean that insertions and deletions occur with different mechanisms, for instance? That like small insertions, deletions can just be caused by replication errors. Larger insertion deletions are transpositions from somewhere else.
Right. So if the sequence is repetitive, it's more easy to
do. Right.
Yeah.
That is right. So I'm just proposing to look at this a different way. I'm not saying we're done here in any case. I knew this would generate a good discussion. And the
Yeah.
And also, I mean, the only thing we actually say, this is neutral stabilizing evolution, right? If the things become adaptive and we don't have a model for that, then, I mean, the whole thing falls apart, right? Because the only thing I say is that you have the specific restrictions and they need to be obeyed. If there's actually positive selection to get a new factor here, well, how do we put this in such a general thing, right? That's a totally different story. So this is basically just, in a way, what I wanted to do is to have more realistic data sets where you can look at how these alignment algorithms work that people actually use every day to make claims about, oh, we see turnover of transcription factor binding sites, or we use it in motif finding, we only look in aligned regions. Like, how bad is that actually, right? Because you don't have the biologically annotated data sets to do this, so you have to resort to simulations. And the simulations I've seen so far are just very, very simple. So this is sort of half a step up to say, well, let's generate something which I think some people could agree on, like all the things scramble around in enhancers, and we generate this over, you know, different evolutionary distances and see when the things start breaking down. So this is an assumption, but at least then you have defined what you know what will happen in your sequence set, and then you can look at the algorithm if whether that's actually able to recover that, right? That doesn't mean you've solved the whole biology, you've set the problem that you set out to solve, right? Okay, so the general framework is basically that we simulate ancestral sequences from a higher order background model and evolve each of those sequences quite a large number of time because, you know, things can happen differently in evolution. We just throw random mutations with a specified rate along the sequence. And so these are basically some of the parameters we'll use here. And other than the background sequences, you put a set of constraints in there. For instance, the overall GC content shouldn't completely drift away because apparently there's some pressure to keep that in a specified range. Which number of what sites do you have in there? What's the relative location to the transcription start site? Does it matter which strand it's on, or is a strand unspecific? What's your threshold to actually minimally still call this a site? And then you just run this, and you can analyze what you get out at the end. Yeah. No, it's not, and I was fighting with my postdoc why the hell he said it that high. We have a few other... it was a postdoc on loan who had left at the time when we really actually got into writing this up. We did simulation studies where we had changed the... yeah, I saw this glance here. That was interesting. Social interaction here. Let's put it this way. If your hair is gray, you have more authority. I'm happy as it is right now. Anyway. Right. So we actually did simulations with different transition transversion ratios, with lower ones than what we actually specified here. And it qualitatively doesn't really change the picture. You see some small differences. The point is that we also go, the way we do this is to go stepwise with short increments, right? And then show the mutations on there. And you could sort of think that, yeah, getting to a transversion is sort of a more longer term process. It is, qualitatively, it doesn't make a big difference. And if you're not happy, hopefully we'll publish this thing soon, and then everybody can set their own rates. That's the idea. Yep. Okay, that's, we will get there. We'll get there. This is just a framework. Yes. Yes, and we take this basically from estimated distances, substitution rates for the mammalian tree or for a particular species or something like that. And you set that, of course, as well.
So when you say one there, number of people, yep, it means it has to be precisely one. You can't go to two, you can't go to zero.
That's another thing. Why, for instance, and these are things that, again, you know, we tested some specific scenarios, and what I hope people will do is go around and play around and see how that changes. We set this here to exactly one. That's why the turnover rates are probably lower than they actually are, that we observe, because you need to have precisely one. It can't be that you get two. Because you have sites that are close to the threshold, and within the step, because we go incrementally in steps, we can have a new site arising and the site disappearing within the same step.
In one step. Mm-hmm.
Because we look at very small steps.
Yeah, but right? If you look at small enough, you can only, you would never get it, right?
That is true. It's, again, it's a model to generate sequences that have specific properties. And this is, again, something, right? You have discussions, people do one thing, later on you think, you ask, why the hell did you set it exactly this way? And then, you know, you don't want to redo everything, but this is thing that, exactly, these are the things you want to study, right? Put in two sites and say it's one or two and see if the turnover rates are drastically different. And they probably, for this thing, that should actually make quite a big difference. Probably around 8 to 10 nucleotides. Okay. So what we can then see is at a particular, for instance, at a particular distance and particular, basically particular rates, we get different distributions. If we start from one ancestral sequence and we evolve it to see then an average 0.1 substitutions per site, we see particular distribution of, for instance, how frequently the site has turned over. Right? And you get sort of a distribution profile because we simulate 1,000 sequences and run 1,000 histories. You get basically a distribution of the total turnover event of this million sequences. And you get a profile like this. And then you can do this for different divergence distances measured in substitutions per site and see what you actually get out. And this is basically for two sets here, one where we started with a simulated set and put E2F sites in there, and then a set where we actually took known E2F target promoters with known E2F target sites and started from there just to see if that actually makes a difference, right? Are our simulated sequences anywhere near the reality, or would you see different things if you start from real human E2F promoters? They are actually almost identical. It was interesting to see. And then you can basically, what we plot here is the mean and the median of these distributions you saw on the different site, sort of turned over the site and plotted against the divergence distance. Yeah? Yeah. Yeah. Pardon? No. No, no. This is all because we know the history, so we can actually see where which position corresponds to which position in the derived sequence. Right? This is all from simulations at this point. It's the substitutions, the average substitutions per site.
Per site?
Yeah.
Per site.
Yes. No, per nucleotide. Yes. Yes, this could be, exactly. So human mouse, for instance, has a distance of 0.6, 0.8. So we just ran this very far. Right? So the distance between human and mouse, which is, as I said, 0.6, 0.8, for this particular scenario, you only would see a few percent of turnover events. And this is, again, that's probably motivated exactly how these parameters were set up and how we allow turnover to happen. Yes. Exactly. Yeah. Right. Because we trace exactly what happens, and then we basically check back in the evolved sequences, do the positions still correspond to the ancestral position, or did it go somewhere else? That's another thing. I think Weichner did this work. It went quite a bit wild in terms of the divergence distance, because things like this you probably wouldn't look at anymore, right? What you can do, for instance, then is just for a particular distance here between. So this was derived from one ancestral sequence, and we look sort of along one branch of a tree how that turns over. Now, for this one, we, for instance, took two branches human mouse with the appropriate distance and just saw, okay, how does the allowed translocation distance matter that you see turnover in both species happening. So you can play around with all these things, right? So this is a scenario of one E2F site in ancestral sequence. We evolve it along the human mouse branch length, and then you ask, has turnover happened in both sites? Not just in one, but both of the sites are in different positions now. And how does the maximum distance you allowed these things to translocate have an influence on this turnover rate? And you can plot so the maximum distance for translocation, one particular set distance, and you see how that actually scales. And this, for instance, scales linearly with the translocation distance, which makes sense, right? The longer you go, it should be linearly the more you see turnover, right? The larger the region is where you allow turnover to happen in, the more turnover you see. Scales linearly, so that makes sense, right? And we looked at one pair, for instance, of E2F and MYC, which often occurs in the same promoters. Again, set this to particular rates, distances. So you here see that we don't allow the relative order to change for these things in that case. Don't put any spatial constraint in there between the two sites, and then we can. So you can play around and see what that changes. If you have no spatial constraint between the two sites, they can independently change their order. And now you say both sites have to be turned over, or only one site has to be turned over, and what are the distributions you actually observe here? And can you still fit this to like a simple model? A simple model would be here that you have a Poisson distribution of the turnover number of turnover events that happened, and you fit the line accordingly. So for exactly one site, you basically specify what's the probability that for each of these sites a turnover event happened in exactly one species, and you actually see that this approximation fits with the observation pretty well. Right? These are independent events. In human or in mouse, exactly one site has turned over, and there is no restriction of if one site is turned over here, how can the other site still turn over, right? There's no spatial constraint. So now if you do put a spatial constraint in here and you say, do both sites have turned over at the end of the human-mouse evolution, then, of course, the simple model of independence doesn't work anymore, because once one site has turned over, depending on where the location was where it turned over and you have a spatial constraint, then you can't simply fit this with an independent model anymore, right? And that's what you see happening here, that the actual observed rates then, of course, smaller than the expected rates if you had no spatial constraint here, right? So these are sort of simple things that you can do with a simulator like this, think is interesting enough to just get some ideas of how large these turnover rates are if you specify specific things, and in a particular distance, how frequent would you really see scrambling of sites happening? Is this something that just occurs frequently by chance, or does it look like, hey, these enhancer reconfigurations, if you blow this up to more complicated modules, which we haven't done, it's really sort of the exception. You don't see that happening a lot. It seems that there is a lot of, once you have this one conformation, it really gets stuck in this new conformation. One just simple example we did with this is then to say, can we evaluate how alignment algorithms are actually doing, even if they're not specifically designed for non-coding sequence evolution, right? So we generate sequences with a simulator. So in this case, it's a sequence of, I think, 2 kb long, where we put 6 different sites in there. And we allow turnover to happen because the model allows it to happen. But the way it was, we are actually almost too nice in how we set this up. So the turnover rate and the success of the algorithm is actually better than what I thought. But I think this is sort of an upper level, the best world scenario, once you allow for turnover sites to happen. Why is this a good, or why are we too nice here? Because we allow for turnover, but for no rearrangement of sites. So they're relatively far apart from each other, and we allow them to translocate, but not to flip, which the algorithms can't really deal with, because most of them are local or global left-to-right alignment algorithms that don't allow for these arrangements. So we already knew, well, these things they can't find, so it would be not very nice to put those in, even though it would be good to get an idea how frequently they would have to deal with a situation like this. We also evaluate the accuracy averaged over pairwise alignments. So even if one species is wrongly aligned, you still get some score out of it. We don't say it's completely wrong. Hey, 4 out of 5, you aligned correctly. The fifth one was off. Well, we don't say it's completely wrong. It's still, 80% correct. So that's nice, I think too nice. And then the third one, actually, that is most important, again, discussions you could have with your postdoc, the sites that he chose are actually very long. So these sites are on average 15, 20 nucleotides long, and this is very atypical for eukaryotic factors. Usually the sites you see probably have a core of like 8 to 10 nucleotide with extended similarity. So we actually make it quite easy for the algorithms to find these things. And these are the sites we used with the length and the restrictions. And then the tree that we used is basically here, a mammalian species tree with dog, cow, mouse, and then human baboon actually is very close species. And then we can look at how these things actually, again, the divergence here is a divergence scale. So one is actually, again, I think he went a bit too far outside there, but you can sort of see when this would actually start to break down, as you said, where the alignments really don't work anymore. And so scale one is basically the tree as it is specified here, which is estimated on protein coding sal and site substitutions. And then we just blow up or shrink that tree, keeping the branch length, the relative branch length, the same. And let me see what I show here is with the increasing number of species. So here it's just human baboon. This is human baboon mouse. This is human baboon mouse dog, and then this with cow as well. This axis here is basically the accuracy. How many of the sites do we still get aligned at the end of the day? So correctly aligned, but again, if you have more than 2 species, it's the pairwise average, as I said. So if you have it correctly aligned in 3 species out of 5, you still get an average 0.6 and not 0 for that one site. And again, this is all averaged over. One would mean that all the positions in the site in all the species are completely still aligned to each other. And then if you miss a few nucleotides or if you miss a few species, that accuracy goes down. Right? And again, these are averages. This is from Kim and Sherlander's group. Kim and Sherlander in Berkeley. It is relatively new. I think it came out 2005 or so. It's still a protein coding algorithm, but that's the one that actually does the best, and we can also tell you why. So let me go through this, and then I'll give you some ideas. Yes, that is. That's what he said. In essentially, this muscle algorithm actually does better, and we'll tell you why. But let me finish. Yes. Okay, so there are a few things that you can observe here. So first of all, so So there is Avid in there and Vista, which were used early on. There is There's Avid and Lagan in there. There's Cluster W as the normal standard in there. There's Muscle in there and Dialine.
But you didn't really sort of align with like slot calls and keep talking that try to avoid this progressive alignment error by looking at all the
No, we didn't use those, but I'll tell you that this Muscle essentially is probably along those same lines. We try to get sort of a range of different underlying algorithms, but then not use each one of each category because that would just get nuts, right? If you try to do this. So, I mean, Cluster W is really the early progressive alignment algorithm that everybody compares to. Then you have these whole genome algorithms that are basically based on perfect sequence matches that they then start chaining together. That's like Avid or Lagan. Then you have Dialine, which basically, as far as I know, doesn't use any, they don't use really any evolutionary tree and just chain the segments together, which probably makes sense if you have sort of block level conservation. And then you have Muscle, which is a progressive aligner but allows to refine things. So it doesn't get stuck with the alignment it did at the leaves. It actually goes back after aligning each species and refines the alignment that it has done so far. And that's basically the reason why it actually does better. Because what you see is that in general, the trend is that, of course, I mean, this is not looking at specificity, so meaning a fraction of total sites that you align. These are only the sites, the accuracy of the transcription factors that we detect. So there's half of the picture in a way missing. But what you see is that the detection accuracy goes down with increasing number of species. And that is usually because the programs propagate the errors that they make. If you have a progressive aligner and you make one error, then there's no way you could ever align the sequence correctly to this wrongly aligned sequence. So, I mean, you read this and there's still, I checked this yesterday because I wondered how widespread this is, but you do get papers that say like, oh yeah, let's align all these species because it's great for aligning non-coding sequences, and it's actually not really. The more you align, the more you will lose. So the things that you find are probably really these highly conserved, ultra-conserved elements, but not actually realistic promoter sequences. There, you get worse if you align more and more species in terms of the sites that you pick up. Because, I mean, the other assumption would be that you say, oh, if you go far enough, then the sites have evolved enough that only the good stuff is left and it's easy to align. But somehow in this progressive framework that pretty much all algorithms use, that's not really what happens. Right? Yeah, so here we went really in the distance of the tree, in the order of the tree. Yeah, I mean, there's, as I said, there's the flip side of the coin that in human baboon, basically everything is aligned and it's effectively meaningless of actually defining your sites. If you... Yes, that is true. We didn't do this partially because Mike Eisen has this paper by Dan Pollard, so from Mike Eisen's group there was an evaluation. They basically said that the overall accuracy is basically proportional to the longest pairwise distance in your set of species that you align. So whatever the furthest two species to each other are, that's what will mess it up, essentially. That was their conclusion.
I want to make sure that I understand the statement that you're actually making, right? Which is, it seems that you're saying that taking more species is bad. And it seems a little bit, it means that there is something bad because it can't be what we add to the basis that it's inherently bad. So, if I take, let's say, five instead of two species here, and I let my performance function be that I find the size conservatively and correctly aligned to at least one other species.
Yeah, sure.
That number will still go up, right? It's just that obviously if you add completely conserved across all, that number is going to go down.
But that's pretty much what many. So, what I just tried to get here is that I think that people use this still frequently in not the right setting, that the assumptions they make are a bit too strong, right? Like you said with Kellis, it's like you have the overall alignment done probably with cluster W, and it's like these four species. And the point here is, well, that's at the point with the progressive aligners, how they work, you will start losing a lot of stuff, potentially, right? That doesn't mean you can't come up, that's exactly the point, that you can't come up with other frameworks and other strategies where you hopefully circumvent those problems, right?
Okay.
Right, for instance, like with the motif finders, with the exception of yours probably, most of them basically rely on stuff that's in the sequence. Most of them basically make the assumption that everything that you find is in the aligned part of the sequence, right? So if you start losing a lot of the stuff because it can't be aligned anymore, and you make the assumption that your things will always be just in the aligned parts, you know, what's the assumption? The point is then, well, if you make those assumptions, then be careful of what you do and how you choose your species set, right?
You're going to ask that this could serve in everybody.
Yeah.
Then you start shooting yourself the truth of what you do that.
Right. But you still see some papers out there, people just say, oh, yeah, and it's great, and we align this, and the only thing that we still find is this great enhancer that we know of. And it's like, well, yeah, that's a lucky case, because the thing is overall very conserved. But if you sort of look at individual sites and sort of this sea of non-conservation, you would think, so this is sort of another point here, yeah? We took the divergence distance really far out here, right? But the sites are actually quite long. They're 15 to 20 nucleotides long. And this is longer than any of the, you know, the seed matches or something that these algorithms use. So you could think that, hey, at this point, as you said, everything is so diverged that essentially the only thing you should be able to align are those long sites. But that's not what happens, because the thing still aligns other stuff and basically messes up and can't find the site. Other than, for instance, if you're dialign, which was one of the algorithms where you don't see that it gets really, really bad or that you see a strong decrease in performance if you look at more species, because the strategy there is different, right? So this is simply, it's an early evaluation, but I hope that it just, you know, gives a few ideas. Yeah? Well, this is again why I think that, you know, with the simulator you could at least get some ideas of what happens and what probably makes sense to put into the algorithms, right? This is one idea where I hope that, you know, this will give us some useful ideas of what scenarios are actually possible if you play around with certain assumptions. Now, you don't know if these assumptions always hold, but at least it gives you some data sets that are created under those assumptions where you can evaluate whether it works. It is symptomatic, so that this decreases with the number of species is symptomatic how the algorithms are set up. And they were set up for protein coding sequences, where this is probably not such a bad assumption. You have a progressive alignment, you start with the closest species, and you start aligning stuff to it as you go along. But here, when you allow for things that translocations and things like this happen, then this assumption, or that you have a lot of non-conserved parts and a little bit of conservation in there, then this assumption is simply not the greatest anymore. Right? That doesn't mean that there are absolutely no algorithms out there that make other assumptions, or that, like Eric said, you could probably refine your expectations and say, well, I already call something as aligned if it's aligned in three species and not in all four that I'm looking at, or things like that. But again, it's very early to say that, you know, what's actually a success rate of that strategy, right? I'm not sure if I understood that part.
You know, if you want to optimize the function of a very high dimensional space, you can say, well, this is going to optimize the function.
Yep.
And then the actual algorithm you use to do it is a different thing, and that's a little messy. But you have a very large upper boundary.
Yes, and that's, I think, okay. So that's, I think, where the standard aligners, left-to-right aligners that are motivated by protein coding sequences simply solve the wrong function. I think that is pretty much, I would think, a clear case. And where some of the, where you see that some of the functions which, for instance, dial line, which as we heard, doesn't even align the parts, like either it's aligned or it's just not aligned. That's it, right?
I actually don't quite agree with that, because I think the problem that they're trying to solve is to say which positions in these sequences derive from a common ancestor in the ancestor of the species.
Yeah.
So if your side disappears here and appears somewhere else, it doesn't mean that the aligner should not align these sides together, right? Because
I have an answer to this, because this is what the simulation gives us. This is the fraction of sides that has turned over. And you can argue that this part the aligners wouldn't get. This is where the actual results are. That is still quite far away, right? The upper line here is, from the simulations, this is the fraction of sides that has not turned over. The upper line here is always sort of the standard non-turned over sides. So if your argument holds, basically where the site is still alignable to its ancestral position, if your argument holds, what the algorithms would be able to solve is getting close to that upper line. Some of them, yes, some of them do. In muscle, actually, we saw individuals, so we have more things like this on individual transcription factors. Muscle actually sometimes gets higher than that. So you would even expect that if that's the function, the optimists, they actually could do too well. They actually start errors because they start aligning stuff that is not derived from the same ancestral position and get fooled by, or fooled in this case, it's good if you want to define transcription factor binding sites. They start aligning things that are not derived from the ancestor.
So going back, it is exactly along this line.
Yep.
And you still don't know whether it aligns to the right.
We would have to split that up. We could, because it's all simulated, so we could actually check back and make this in sort of two fractions of, you know, the fraction that comes from this side and the fraction that actually comes from this part.
What is actually
what is allowed? I think the point that I'm getting back here, though, is it's a valid point that these algorithms were designed to tell you which positions derive from the same ancestor. In practice, how the people are using them is totally different, though, because they make this claim, oh, we align that stuff, and it tells us where the functional sequence elements are. And I think that's a conclusion that's a bit too wild sometimes. Yes. So we have that as well. It's just not plotted here. So we can. Yes. Yeah. It is actually very similar if you just look over the overall alignment accuracy, meaning you align the nucleotides that come from the same ancestor or at this. Yeah. Yeah. So we can evaluate that too, and we have. It's just not shown here. But the qualitative things is, I mean, I think so, actually. If I'm not wrong, yes. But Clustal W in that case is actually doing quite well, because that's what it was designed to do. And the genome alignment, so in that sense, actually, the algorithms perform as you expected. Because you have Avid and Lagan, which are whole genome aligners, and actually don't really solve that problem. Not as explicitly as Clustal W or Muscle, and you see that they actually perform the worst. They're set up to do whole genome quick alignments, and again, the point is just there that, you know, watch out what you're actually using when you use this for these purposes. That's a good point. Yeah? It also, yes. it also goes down.
So if I only look at the X, it will go down to
X. Yes. If you add this in the particular order, again, we would have to look at different species combinations and see if you start from other, that's the order how you add the species, for instance, make a difference. Especially for the progressive aligners that don't allow you to trace back, it probably has a strong influence how you actually feed the order in it, into those algorithms. But the overall picture is the same, that even there, if you add more species, the overall accuracy goes down. It's to increase the species in the order of the distance in the tree. It's again...
And you take paradoxes in between, and you first align paradoxes, and then you align Nikitae to the paradoxes Cerevisiae alignment, you get a better Cerevisiae and Nikitae alignment than you would get if you didn't first do paradoxes.
Right.
So it matters in what order you, but
The order matters, and of course, what's your actually scoring function then, right? Because now you redefined the scoring function. You didn't say, did I correctly trace the alignment back to the ancestral sequence for all my species, but you said for some of them,
right?
I have one, if you have one sort of target species that you want to get right, and then you start aligning things with respect to that target species, you can probably set these things up differently,
right?
Well, this is just within the transcription factor binding sites. How many of the positions, it's a fraction of how many positions did you get aligned in how many of the sequences. So it's not a zero if you don't get it right in all five. If you have four out of five, it would still give you 0.8, right? He saw that, but again, they looked, I'm not sure what their evaluation criterion was exactly, but they also looked at the transcription factor binding site problem, so I would also think it's the accuracy of detecting those sites. And his thing was that the performance that you achieve is proportional to the most distant pair in your set of species that you put in. Right. So can we probably start finishing? Exactly. I was just there. I was pretty much done anyway, and I just want to show this slide at least that the people that did the work get their credits, and then we can continue then. Okay.